This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, hundreds of fast food workers across the country are walking off their jobs. There were rallies in the Triangle, including this one in Durham.
We can't survive on 725. We can't survive on 725. We can't survive on 725. We can't survive.
They're rallying for higher wages and the right to build a union. Next week, Walmart employees are going to do the same thing. Workers say they're striking for dignity in the workplace and an end to retaliation against Walmart workers. We invited representatives from Walmart and Burger King onto the program. They declined, although Burger King did issue a written statement. You'll hear from that later on. Wilmetta Duke is a Burger King employee and one of the many fast food workers who walked off their jobs today. Hazel Rodriguez is an organizer with Our United for Respect at Walmart, or Our Walmart. Welcome to both of you. Wilmetta, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you.
Tell us how long you've been working at Burger King.
I've actually been there a year, and I've actually been in the working in the fast food industry for over 15.
Why did you get involved in this strike?
I got involved in this strike because I want to change here. I've been watching on the internet and on the TV, and I've been watching how these people have been organizing around the country and standing up for themselves. And I think that here in North Carolina, we need something like that. We need dignity as well. And right now, we're underpaid, overworked, and taken for granted.
How many, you've been working in the industry, what'd you say, for about 15 years?
Yes, sir, I have. I've raised two children working there, and most of the time it's been a couple of jobs. But now that my children are grown, I'm still working very, very hard, and now I'm getting paid even less.
Paid less than you were 15 years ago?
Well, when I mean paid less, I mean the hours. Mm. They're decreasing our hours. Before I could work, I was barely scraping by. Now I'm really not even getting by.
Do you have any benefits, medical benefits, or paid time off, or any of that?
No, sir. I don't receive any of that.
So you've been working two jobs and sometimes three jobs, right?
Yes, sir, I have.
And so how does that go? Have you made enough money, to pay your rent and all the bills, and then I guess transportation and child care, all of that? There are a lot of expenses that go along with trying to even keep three jobs.
Yeah, it is. And it was hard for me as a single mom. Raising those two boys by myself and then working those jobs, it took up a lot of my time, and sometimes 16 hours a day.
I understand that you were hoping that with the Affordable Care Act, that would make your life as in the fast food industry a little bit easier, and you made some changes based on your expectations. Tell us about what you expected to happen and what really did happen.
Well, I expected there to be a change, and for me, as I said, to be able to support myself, and I do have a few health issues from working like I have over the years. So I was hoping with the act that things would be a little bit more better for me, that I would get the health care that I need, and that now that it's only me and my kids are 20 and 21, I felt like maybe I could, it was only me now. But with this act, I figured it was a good thing. But now that my hours are decreasing, because these companies don't want to give us health care, they would rather cut my hours back to 24 to 27 hours a week.
And that puts you under the limit. And so then you're not only are you making less money, but you're certainly not then on the Affordable Care Act. So they don't have to provide health care.
So, yes, and I think that is so unfair. I work hard. I'm a decent person. I've been doing this a long time. I know that I'm good at what I do. So why shouldn't I be paid for it?
I want to talk to Hazel Rodriguez right now from Our Walmart, the Walmart strike planned for next week, and this fast food worker strike. Hazel, do you see a connection between the two?
Absolutely. Thank you for having us on the show today. This moment is very important for all the low-wages workers nationwide, right, including, as you will say, our brothers and sisters from the fast food workers industry and the Walmart workers. Like many Americans, right, are still struggling to make ends meet. So this is definitely a real connection between these two type of workers, these two type of industries.
What is forgive me for interrupting. What is our Walmart?
Mm-hmm. Our Walmart is an organization called United for Respect at Walmart, and it was formed by current associates, but also former associates that comes together nationwide to stand up for the rights.
And what are those rights, and what is it that you're actually asking for in particular?
Sure, absolutely. As you must know, all those Walmart workers are heavily invested in their job, right? They develop this relationship with customer. They have been working in some of the stores for 15, 18 years. This is their life. Their family, their relatives work there as well. So it is part of their life, and they take this job very seriously. Unfortunately, as Walmart grows as a company and expands, workers are still facing low wages and very few benefits. They have more part-time positions than full-time positions, and even they want to work more and they want to have a decent living. They are forced, most of them, to seek a public assistance. And that's why they came together. They want to change. They want to be able to speak out about those issues. And unfortunately, they have been shut down.
Well, tell us about that and what's happened to Walmart workers who have spoken out. I understand that now is one of the concerns because of the experience of Walmart workers who had spoken out before.
Absolutely. Let's look at going back May this year. About more than 100 workers, Walmart associates, went on strike. They went to Bentonville, Arkansas, and this is where Walmart had their headquarters and also their shareholders' annual meeting. So workers went on strike for 2 weeks. When they came back, 70 of them got disciplined. Some of them got fired. Some of them saw their hours being cut. And they are coming together on September 5th to asking Walmart to reinstate those workers who were retaliated against just simply because they stand up for the right. The fact that they went on strike is completely legal because it's a concerted activity under the law because it was done collectively. So has been filed ULPs, unfair labor practices, but in the meantime, workers want to show that they are a united front and they want to do in action nationwide date of action September 5th to show that they are together and they are not going to back up and they are asking Walmart to really seriously taking those concerns into consideration and restate them because they have been doing absolutely nothing wrong for speaking out and come together as they had the right to do so.
Willetta Duke, are you afraid of retaliation now that you participated in the strike?
I was one of the...
Willetta?
Yes, sir. I fear that there will be some, but then I don't. Because at this point, I don't feel that there's much more that I can lose. I mean, and now I have to stand for something. Off anything.
What are the workers, the people who you work with and the people on the lines with you today, what are they saying about that, about the risk of losing everything, what little bit you have?
A little bit.
Yeah, what are the people that you've on the lines today who struck with you also working in the fast food industry? How do they feel about that? Have you talked to them about their fears?
Yes, I have. And right now, we have no fear. At this point, no fear.
Let me ask you, I'm going to ask you this and hey, Saul, the same thing. What we hear from the fast food industry and what we hear from Walmart and others is if we raise, here's what we hear from industry and the corporations and their shareholders. What they say is, if we're not going to cut our profits, we want our profits. So what we're going to have to do is cut the workforce. So if you are successful in your demands, we will simply lay people off because you're going to increase the cost of doing business and there will be more people on unemployment. Let me start with you, Hazel.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, we hear that very often. And if you look at the big picture, Walmart is the biggest retailer in the entire world. Not only looking at U.S. perspective, they have businesses overseas. And they are growing and they're expanding, right? Which is, you know, is okay. At the same time, you have to look at how come you are, it's like a threat, right? Telling the workers, if we pay you more as you deserve, we want to cut down on the workforce. this is a contradiction, because you will mean that you will not be able to provide the service that you need to, you know, in first place. But second of all, if you look at, for example, one of the CEO, like Mike Duke, he made last year only in profit $16 billion last year. And if you look at how much money a Walmart worker made in average, a full-time average, how much money they make a year, it's an average of $12,000. So definitely by increasing on salaries, by giving a worker a steady schedule and provide benefit, there is no need for them to cut the workforce. They have enough profit to provide that for them.
Well, Letta Duke, how do you feel about that?
I feel like that's not going to happen. I believe it's a bluff, because these companies are making billions of dollars. The industry every day is increasing in their sales and their volume. So how can, if they give us a raise, they're going to have to cut back? Then that means they're going to have to cut back on their business, and that's not going to happen.
I want to thank both of you for being on our program today. Willetta Duke, Burger King employee, one of the many fast food workers who walked off their jobs today. Hazel Rodriguez, an organizer with the organization United for Respect at Walmart. Thank both of you for being on the program today.
Thank you for having us.
Another fast food walkout will happen in Raleigh on Martin Street Baptist Church, 3:30 this afternoon, the Walmart strike in Raleigh, September 5th. And there's more on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about labor movements here in North Carolina and around the nation. Before the break, we were talking about workers and organizers in the fast food industry and Walmart. And now we're going to look back at the history of labor struggles in North Carolina. David Zondermann is a history professor at North Carolina State University. Bob Korstad is a professor of public policy and history at Duke University. Welcome back. Good to have both of you on the program.
Thanks.
First of all, what did you make of our conversation in our first segment with Willetta and Hazel? David, start with you.
Well, one of the things I was struck by was they both said the sense that at least the workers they're dealing with, they said, had no fear. And that reminds me of several times in American labor history back in the late 19th century and again during the Depression, when workers' backs were to the wall and you would think they would have felt so beaten down they would have just resigned. But instead they said, we have nothing left to lose. We're going to fight back. So that may be the beginning of a trend.
Bob?
I was struck by how similar the complaints and the concerns that the workers have today are to ones that have been the historical issues that workers in North Carolina, particularly low-wage workers, have organized around: wages, working conditions, dignity on the job. So listening to them is like listening to many of the oral histories that I've done of workers in North Carolina. The issues are, are very much the same.
Now, interestingly enough, in North Carolina, this is one of the least organized states in the nation, and it's always been that way, and yet one of the most industrialized states in the South, with textile and tobacco. Why is that? Why was there so much industry for a southern state and so little union organizing here?
Well, the union organizing efforts have been actually quite dramatic, and they've gone on really throughout the 20th century. I think there are a lot of complicated reasons why the rates of unionization were low. I mean, one of the issues was the racial division of labor and the way that black workers and white workers got played off against each other. Another issue was the role of the state in suppressing worker insurrection. And I think another issue is I'm not sure that national unions understood the concerns and the issues of southern workers in the way that they should have. And I think there have been a lot of issues that have come together.
David, were those concerns different than other industries in the North? Southern workers?
Well, I think one thing that Bob said I absolutely agree with. One was the complexities and the tensions of race. Now, they're certainly true up north as well, but they play out in different ways here in the South. And the other difference was, I mean, textile is a really good example. Textile mills run differently and, in effect, look differently than, say, a steel mill or an auto assembly plant. And you can't quite organize them the same way. And the owners of these mills often had a different attitude. Many of them were owned by small family firms and were aggressively cutting prices, cutting wages. So I agree with Bob. There was a sense of you needed to understand the South more, and a lot of the big national unions were slow to do that.
There were strikes. Talk about the strike of 1929 in Gastonia.
Yeah, no, a big strike there and an even bigger one in 1934 that spread from Georgia all the way up to Rhode Island. But in both cases, again, Bob mentioned this, and I absolutely agree, they were literally beaten down. I mean, National Guardsmen were called out, local police, militia. People were literally put into the bullpens in South Carolina in 1934 in a little town called Hanaya Path. Six people were just shot dead in the middle of the street, and there were people there who literally didn't talk about it for over half a century. So it's brutal, and it leaves very, very painful memories.
And in the negotiations to end the violence, there were agreements not to retaliate, agreements to improve some of those conditions when the corporations and the businesses didn't live up to them. The federal government did nothing to enforce those agreements. Isn't that part of what happened?
That's right. I mean, particularly after the 1934 strike, the federal government was supposed to protect the agreements and the deals that had been made with the workers, and they just backed out. They just didn't do any of it.
Interestingly enough, here this is one of the few states where collective bargaining is illegal for public sector workers as well. Right?
Yeah, I mean that's a real deterrent to organizing public workers, which has been one of the fastest growing sectors of employment since World War II, and also a sector of employment that seems to concentrate large numbers of African Americans and women workers. And so I think that the strictures against organizing in the public sector have limited the opportunities for those workers.
And I guess, is there a culture of union organizing? I mean, does that make a difference if you live in a place where a lot of people are in a union? Does it make a difference? And if people aren't, you know, is it harder to organize, harder to get started?
Yeah, absolutely. There is almost a kind of momentum effect. And I think it's probably due to a couple of things. One is you see people around you in a union. You see the benefits they get. It looks like a possibility. You can do it. And the other is, of course, the stronger the labor movement, the more political clout it can have. Again, Bob's written about this. Unions organized and influence local elections. They have a greater role in state politics in states like New York and California than they certainly do here, though. Although the AFL-CIO certainly tries in this state, but they just don't have a lot of money or numbers or clout behind them.
Now, there was an important labor victory, and Bob, you've written about this, Local 22 in Winston-Salem. Tell us about that.
Well, it was a local that was organized in 1943 in the midst of World War II by a largely African-American workforce at R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. It was about two-thirds of the workers were African-American. And they suffered from some of the same conditions that these young women were talking about this morning, low pay, lack of dignity on the work, lack of benefits. And, you know, for a number of years, they had tried in different ways to organize. But again, here, this was a place where the split between black and white workers was very real. And the company played on that, telling white workers, well, if you get organized, well, we'll just replace you with black workers, and telling black workers the same thing. But this was a situation where people had just had enough. And it was a very quick organizing effort. They won collective bargaining rights. They set to work on, organizing the community politically, helped to elect an African-American alderman in 1947, and won, real concessions from the company and from the city government.
And it started with a strike. I mean, that was the first action, right?
That was right. There was a sit-down strike in one of the plants, and the next day that involved a few hundred workers. The next day there were 1,500 workers out on the street, and the next day there were 7,000 workers. And so the union went from 40 dues-paying members to about 7,000 in a course of a week. So, you know, you could the pin-up demand and concern for these issues was there.
You talk about this was 1943. So not only is there a risk of retaliation losing your job, this is Jim Crow. You can go to jail or worse for
right.
this kind of demonstration.
That's right. And this was a situation where I think the solidarity of African-American workers in a town like Winston-Salem, where they had strong institutions, strong churches, strong support in their community, so they could withstand the kind of pressure that was put on them. Whereas, you know, I think it, in the fast food industry, we've got people spread out and organize. I mean, living in all kinds of different places and different circumstances, it makes organizing more difficult.
Well, is it though, through social media, at least you can get the word out faster, and there are a lot of people in the same situation. And if you look at low-wage workers in the aggregate and not just fast food and Walmart workers, then you see a lot of people concentrated in a lot of places. David, does that make a difference? I mean, this is a different kind of organizing in a very different atmosphere, but what is the potential for a real organization, a larger organization, to form around these issues?
Well, I think when you said social media, I think you hit on something really important. I mean, just pick up on what Bob said. One of the things that I think a lot of us that deal with the labor movement have been urging for a generation is you got to go where the workers are, and the workers are in the service sector. But as Bob said, up until fairly recently, many organizers said, but they're really hard to organize. They're in small units. They're scattered. They're very low wage. They're easily replaced. That's what the bosses threaten. But you're right. Now we have the tools of social media, which means you can now reach hundreds, thousands, millions of folks with a simple email, Facebook, whatever it is. And that's, I think organizers, particularly the younger generation of organizers, very savvy to that. And that's potentially changing the game.
Well, and to get some perspective on that and how things might change, I want to go back a little bit, because there were efforts to organize workers in North Carolina. Bob, maybe you can talk about Operation Dixie down here in the CIO.
Yeah, in the aftermath of World War II, the CIO, which was the Organization of Industrial Workers in the United States, took on Operation Dixie, which was an effort to really solidify the union movement in the North by organizing the low-wage workers in the South, because they were afraid at that time that shops would start moving to the South to take advantage of the low rates of unionization. And so they were trying to shore up their own factories. Again, it was not very successful. In fact, it was quite a big failure. And I think a lot of reasons. I don't think the organizers understood the South, and they ran into this issue of racial animosity and the use of racial divisions by employers and by the state government to really put a damper on that organizing effort.
Well, you talked about the divisions, too, and the way that workers are divided. It's interesting because, as we said, we invited Walmart and Burger King to be on the program. They declined to have a presence on the program. Burger King did send us a written statement. For decades, Burger King restaurants have provided an entry point into the workforce for millions of Americans, including many of the system's franchisees who began their careers at local Burger Kings. As a corporation, we respect the rights of all workers. However, Burger King Corporation doesn't make hiring or firing or other employment-related decisions for our franchisees, and they point out that the restaurants are independently owned, and that's their boast, that these are independently owned. But that also is a kind of fragmentation. It makes it more difficult to organize, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, their point about entry level is what they're playing on is what I would call almost a receding myth. I mean, we have this idea that every high school kid gets his first job or her first job at a Burger King or McDonald's or whatever. And that's true for some high school kids, but a lot of them, if you go now into many fast food places, you are seeing men and women, particularly men and women of color, that are in their 20s, 30s, 40s. And as the woman who joined us said, she's been working 15 years. This is not a high school gal working a few months before she goes off to college. So they're kind of spinning that old mythology to try to say, oh, that's what all we're doing.
Well, they do it. NPR's Jennifer Ludden spoke with Scott DeFife. She did a piece that aired this morning on Morning Edition on restaurant workers. Scott DeFife is the Executive Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs at the National Restaurant Association. Here's what he says.
It's there for people who have had, you know, economic difficulties in the past or who may not have finished, you know, 4 years of a college or university program.
And that has changed. And in fact, now the average age has gone from 19 in the past 20 years to 29. So the average age of the so it's quite right. The people he's talking about no longer work at Burger King. And if they do, they're in the minority. And so, but then the question is, can they afford to? Now you're talking about families, you're talking about parents with two and three kids and perhaps some health issues. You know, can they afford to take the front lines and risk their jobs? I guess we heard from Willette and others that the time has come, huh?
Yeah, I think they don't have any choice anymore. And I think the other important point here is that ordinary citizens, the consumers, the people who are shopping in these stores, need to understand that, you know, if somebody's getting paid $7.50 an hour, they're not able to access health care. They're not able to have an adequate amount of food for themselves. There are all kinds of benefits or all kinds of needs that are having to be met by us, whether it's through our taxes, whether it's through the donations to the food bank or the thrift stores and stuff. Ordinary Americans, middle-class Americans, are doing an awful lot to support these companies that are paying low wages. And it's not just in, you know, it's partly in the high salaries of executives and stuff, but, you know, a lot of that money's coming out of our pocket.
Buying the stuff. So what was the role of consumers in the history of the labor movement? Certainly there was a robust labor movement in the United States in the 30s where labor was really very active and through the 40s and at least powerful in the post-war period. But what was going on there? Were consumers playing a part in that? Were there boycotts associated with the strikes that helped bring leverage against corporations?
Well, you can even go back earlier than that. Right around the turn of the 20th century, you start to get what's called the Consumer League movement, which was the first attempt to reach out, particularly the middle-class women shoppers, and say basically only shop. They use what they call the white label, and they said only shop, buy goods that are labeled being made in clean factories, by workers that are well-treated, et cetera, et cetera. And they also, this was an early movement to improve the condition of young women who worked in the retail industry. It was also go to stores that treat their own clerks well as well. And you're right about – and the other thing that was going on was many unions were promoting boycotts. I guess I'm old enough to remember even when back in the 60s when you heard about a boycott, whether it was the Great Boycott or another, people really paid attention. And that's another case where I think social media can come back. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which mobilizes tomato pickers, has done some very effective boycotts against groups like Taco Bell and Burger King to get them to mobilize the public to say we're not going to buy your burgers until you pay a penny pound more for the tomatoes.
And they were effective. Certainly yes. The Great Boycott, the Safeway Boycott, all of those had profound effects. So what happened to the labor movement? It was strong. There were unions. Unions were robust going through the 60s and into the 70s. What happened?
Again, there's many reasons why, I would argue. Certainly the economy shifted and a lot of jobs that had been in the major industrial unions disappeared. Another key thing is it's not that labor law has changed, but the enforcement of labor law or businesses' willingness to abide by labor law changed radically, really starting with Ronald Reagan's break of the air traffic controls, the PATCO strike. And for the past 30 years, businesses have just openly violated labor law. It is illegal to fire somebody for trying to organize a union, but unfortunately, some businesses do it routinely because the penalties are virtually non-existent. So they do it.
But, Bob, the economy has changed. There's a lot of competition from abroad. And so if you simply raise wages and provide these better conditions, then these companies say, well, look, we're not going to be able to compete. We're going to lose jobs. I mean, what about that argument?
Well, I think back to one of the responses that one of the young women made this morning. I mean, these companies are making large profits. The people who work in the executive areas are making a lot of money. The people who supply, whether it's their lawyers, whether it's the ad people. I mean, one of the reasons we're seeing this great wealth inequality and increasing wealth inequality in the United States is that as you've got more and more companies in America, you know, paying large salaries for people at the top and very little for people at the bottom. And it's a real drain and drag on our economy. I mean, I think one of the most important arguments in this minimum wage debate is if you increase, you know, double people's wage rates, it's going to stimulate all kind of other kinds of activity, including the restaurant industry. I mean, it's surprising. I mean, that's probably the industry that will see the quickest growth because of more disposable income among people like this. So I think, you know, a $15 minimum wage is probably one of the best ways to kind of get us out of this recession that we have.
Certainly corporate profits have soared well above wages, particularly since the 1980s. And Dave, that brings us to the point that there was a time when unions were strong, when wages were rising in lockstep with profits. That broke in the 80s as union strength broke as well.
Yes. Right? In fact, if you look at least for the entire span of the 20th century, the period when we were the most prosperous was right after World War II to about the middle of the 1970s. And I would argue it's not a coincidence that is linked to both a strong labor movement and also a progressive tax structure as well. And both of those actually kept that sort of virtuous cycle going.
But the consumer argument that Bob, that you were making, the idea that if we pay our folks more, they can buy more stuff, that used to be an argument when Americans were buying most of the stuff Americans were making. But now businesses are looking abroad and saying, you know, the American market, kind of small change. We don't really need them anymore. Is that part of what's going on here?
Well, I think that may be true in certain manufacturing areas, but certainly in the service sector, which is the fastest growing sector in the country, that's not true. We're not, you know, the services are being consumed here in the United States. So if the service sector is going to be, you know, 50% of the economy, you know, it's really going to benefit us if we can have a vibrant one that pays a lot and keeps that cycle going.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program. Bob Korstad, a professor of public policy and history at Duke. David Zonderman, a professor of history at North Carolina State. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
After the break, how do we measure race beyond phenotype? What it means to act white. Stay tuned.